Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls paper, The Courier, for Tuesday, November 30th, 2021. I'm your reader, Mary Duff. Listeners, let's see if it's your birthday today, who you share your birthday with. Country singer, record company executive Jimmy Bowden is 84. Director Ridley Scott is 84. Writer-director Terrence Mackley from The Thin Red Line is 78. Singer and actor Mandy Packington is 69. Country singer Janine Kendall of The Kendalls is 67. Singer Billy Idol is 66. Comedian Colin Morchi, whose line is it anyway, is 64. Rapper Jay Lil is 58. Ben Stiller is 56. Steve Aoki is 44. Clay Aiken is 43. And model Chrissy Teigen is 36. So happy birthday if you share it on today, this beautiful, sunny, warm day, where we hope to get up to 51 for our last day of November. All right, let's look at our headlines on the front page of the Courier. Murder charges filed in Cedar Falls killing. Vaccine mandate on hold. Fatal fire trial heads to jury. And Cedar Falls mayor city council runoff election today. All right, we'll go to our lead article. Murder charges filed in Cedar Falls killing. Two suspects in custody already, linked to the 2019 robbery turned deadly, by journalist Jeff Renounci, Cedar Falls. Authorities have upgraded charges against two people suspected in the December 2019 fatal robbery attempt in a downtown apartment. On Monday, Cedar Falls police announced they filed first-degree murder charges against 20-year-old Keon Kristen Roby and 22-year-old James Wright Bowles. Bond was set at $1 million each. The arrests pertain to the December 4, 2019 slaying of 24-year-old Grant Saul at Saul's upstairs apartment at 112 Main Street. Both Roby and Wright Bowles had been detained in January of 2020 on conspiracy charges in connection with the slaying. A third person arrested in the case, Marcus Tyrese Gaffney, is also awaiting trial on robbery charges. Prosecutors previously stated in court records it appeared Gaffney provided the gun that killed Saul, who was present during the holdup. Court records alleged the three went to Saul's apartment around 9 p.m. as part of a robbery plan. One person was armed with a handgun, and the suspect began gathering everyone in the apartment into the living room. One of the occupants was later taken to the kitchen and beaten, and Saul drew a handgun he had hidden. Roby fired at least three shots, striking Saul, according to court records. Saul died at the scene, and police found spent 9mm shell casings in the apartment. Our next headline is vaccine mandate on hold. Judge blocks rule for healthcare workers in Iowa, nine other states, by journalist David A. Lieb, Associated Press, Jefferson City, Missouri. A federal judge Monday blocked President Joe Biden's administration from enforcing a coronavirus vaccine mandate on thousands of healthcare workers in 10 states that had brought the first legal challenge against the requirement. The court order said that the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid had no clear authority from Congress to enact the vaccine mandate for providers participating in the two government health care programs for the elderly, disabled, and poor. The preliminary injunction by St. Louis-based U.S. District Judge Matthew Schlepp applies to a coalition of suing states that includes Alaska, Arkansas, Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, New Hampshire, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming. Similar lawsuits also are pending in other states. The federal rule requires COVID-19 vaccinations for more than 17 million workers nationwide in about 76,000 healthcare facilities and home healthcare providers that get funding from the government health programs. Workers are to receive their first dose by December 6th and their second shot by January 4th. The court order against the healthcare vaccine mandate comes after Biden's administration suffered a similar setback for a broader policy. A federal court previously placed a hold on a separate rule requiring businesses with more than 100 employees to ensure their workers get vaccinated or else wear a mask and get tested weekly for the coronavirus. Biden's administration contends federal rules supersede state policies prohibiting vaccine mandates and are essential to slowing the pandemic. But the judge in the healthcare provider case wrote that federal officials likely overstepped their legal powers. CMS seeks to overtake an area of traditional state authority by imposing an unprecedented demand to federally dictate the private medical decisions of millions of Americans. Such an action challenges traditional notions of federalism, Schlepp wrote in his order. Even under an exceedingly broad interpretation of federal powers, Congress did not clearly authorize CMS to enact this politically and economically vast federalism-altering and boundary-pushing mandate, Schlepp wrote. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, who joined the lawsuit, issued a statement in which she applauded the court's decision. Medical providers that have been on the front lines of this pandemic, saving lives, deserve the freedom and ability to make their own informed health care decisions, Reynolds said in the statement. I believe the vaccine is the best defense against COVID-19, but I also firmly believe in Iowans' right to make health care decisions based on what's best for themselves and their families, and I remain committed to protecting those freedoms. President Biden should do the same. Next article is Fatal Fire Trial Heads to the Jury. It's accompanied by a picture of the defense attorney, Wendy Samuelson, that said the state didn't meet its burden of proof in the trial of Denise Suzanne O'Brien on Monday. Woman allegedly set house fire that killed Waterloo mom and son, by journalist Jeff Fernounzi. Waterloo. Jurors are considering the case of a Waterloo woman accused of setting a house fire in 2018 that killed a boy and his mother. The jury began deliberations in the case of Denise Susanna O'Brien, 45, on Monday afternoon following a week of testimony. When you start a house on fire and don't give people a way out, they die. When you start a house on fire with a specific purpose of design to do physical injury, they die. It's murder. Blackhawk County Attorney Brian Williams told jurors on closing arguments that wrapped up in the trial over the blaze that killed 9-year-old Jaquan Salas and his mother, 32-year-old Ashley Smith. O'Brien is charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder. In the deaths, the state alleges she set the fire because she was angry that her boyfriend, Willie Tremone Phillips, was spending the night with a friend of Smith's, Tyrone Netz, who also lived at the home. Phillips, Netz, and a 12-year-old girl escaped by jumping from second-floor windows, but Jaquan and Smith were trapped and died of smoke inhalation and burns. The defense maintains police didn't investigate other possible suspects, other people that Phillips and Netz had been seeing, including a doorman at an after-hours club where the two had been shortly before the fire. Nobody sees who sets the fire, defense attorney Wendy Samuelson said. If you have doubts, your verdict should be not guilty. Williams told jurors that even though Smith and Jaquan weren't the intended targets, O'Brien can still be found guilty of murder in their deaths. In order to return a conviction, jurors have to find that O'Brien set the fire and acted with malice and committed arson, and that the mother and child died as a result of the fire. The state contends that jurors can find malice in the fact that separate fires were set at the only 2 doors out of the home, effectively blocking the only traditional exits, and that the fire was started as people were inside sleeping. Williams said O'Brien knew there were children in the house because she told Phillips and police investigators so when she denied any involvement after the fire. Williams pointed out similarities between the April 22, 2018 fire and a confrontation 2 weeks earlier in which O'Brien broke front windows on the house and pushed over a TV set. Both incidents happened around 6 a.m. while Phillips and Netz were at the house, and both involved the front porch, which contained an old couch. She goes to the front porch of the residence with gasoline and douses the couch, and poof, up goes the porch, Williams said, almost the exact time of day as well. The state also alleges that O'Brien can be seen in videos at nearby businesses walking toward her West 4th Street apartment moments after passerbyers spotted the fire. The defense said the person in the videos isn't O'Brien. Samuelson said the video shows someone with different facial features and a different body type. She said the state didn't have DNA or fingerprints pointing to who set the fire. Also, there was no evidence of gasoline on O'Brien's clothing or shoes, and no testimony that anyone near her after the fire noticed an odor of gas or smoke. Samuelson noted, there was also no testimony or other evidence about O'Brien's obtaining gasoline, she said. All right, our last article on the front page of the Courier for Tuesday, November 30th, Cedar Falls Mayor Council runoff elections today. Green Sires face off for mayor, Cruz Yates battle for Ward 3, by journalist Andy Malone, Cedar Falls. Polls will be open in Cedar Falls from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Tuesday for the runoff elections for mayor and the Ward 3 City Council seat. The 15 polling locations, which were opened for the November 2nd city and school elections, will be available for voting in the runoffs. Councilors Dave Sires and one-term incumbent Rob Green are vying for the two-year mayor term. Ward 3, voters will choose between one-term incumbent Daryl Cruz and challenger Carol Yates for the four-year seat. Nobody in the November 2nd three-candidate race for mayor and the council seat tallied more than 50% of the total to win outright, sparking the separate runoffs. To find your polling location, visit https://sos.iowa.gov/elections/voterreg/polling-place/search.aspx. Voters are required to provide proof of identity, which as an Iowa driver's license at the polls. If you do not have a driver's license or state-provided ID card, or have other questions about voting, contact the County Auditor and Commissioner of Elections by calling 319-833-3007 or sending an email to elections@blackhawkcounty.iowa.gov. People who did not vote November 2nd but are eligible to register may appear in person Tuesday at the polling place in their precinct where they reside and vote after completing a registration application, making written oath and providing an acceptable proof of both identity and residence. Resident with absentee ballots must return them to the election office, which is located on the second floor of the county courthouse during business hours, or place them in the drop box near the parking lot entrance of the courthouse. Absentee ballots must be returned to the office by 8 p.m. on election day. Postmarks no longer matter, said the election office in a Facebook post. Do not drop your ballot in the mail, as it is likely will not arrive at our office in time. Absentee ballots will not be accepted at a polling place. They can be surrendered and void instead, and a person can then vote in person. 5 p.m. Monday was the deadline for early voting in the courthouse. Cedar Falls Christian Church, 2727 West 4th Street, was available as a satellite location for early voting for all Cedar Falls residents from 9 to 3 p.m. Saturday, November 20th. As of 1:30 p.m. Monday, Amy Jensen, a county election office specialist, said 1,029 early ballots had been received because the absentee mail-ins and those cast at the satellite location in the county election office. All right, let's turn our attention to some Cedar Valley news. And this article features a 20 under 40 awardee, and the headline reads, Bridging the Gap, Purvis Williams Levels the Playing Field for Disadvantaged Youth, by journalist Pat Kenny, Waterloo. Purvis Williams is all about bringing the scales of opportunity more into balance for disadvantaged youth and individuals with special needs. He's involved in Project Ready Community Outreach, his own organization benefiting youth, and is a program director for REM of Iowa Community Services, helping special needs individuals. I am the founder, owner of Project Ready Community Outreach, said Williams, 30, a native of Mississippi who moved to Iowa to join family and was educated here. I do a lot with reaching out to the community, bridging the gap in the community. He has applied for nonprofit status for the organization and is in search of a building. We are going to be rolling out our mentoring program for youth in the community. And this building is going to have after-school programs. We're going to work with taking them on college tours, applying for jobs, different things like that. He also initiated an Adopt a Senior program, which supported graduating high school seniors through the pandemic. We did graduation open house for them in a big general location. We did a prom 2 years in a row. We did a senior parade for them, just kind of giving them a sense of normalcy during this pandemic. We reached about 600 students within 8 different counties. It's something I decided to do to give back to the community and make an impact in the community and work on bridging the gap within the community. With Project Ready Community Outreach, Williams said, we will be going into the schools and reaching out to those students in the schools and figure out what needs to be done to better assist them to make it through school. We will have after-school programs, programs for them in the summer, mentoring, tutoring, and college prep. Just get them prepared for life after school. He also organized the Summer Soul Classic Parade in conjunction with the past summer's North End Arts and Music Fest. Amazing turnout, he said. We had 11 drill teams from all over the Midwest come in and participate. He's been at REM for 6 years. We work with intellectually disabilities and brain injuries. He does residential work and operates the Day Habilitation Center. He saw the need for his youth work from his previous job with Waterloo Community Schools as a behavior intervention specialist for about 5 years. They need a lot of people to advocate, support, and be there for them. I wanted a program that was centered toward the youth and geared and run by the youth. The youth will create programs they think will benefit them, and we will have the facilitators come in and assist that. He draws motivation and reward from the kids and other people he serves. The motivation is seeing the smiles on their faces, the accomplishments they've made, seeing that sense of the sense on their face of, hey, I did this, I succeeded at this, makes it all worth it and keeps me going, keeps me wanting to do more. Williams is the definition of the heart of Waterloo, said Tanera Wade, one of the nominating him from 20 under 40. He has the biggest heart of people. I have seen him go without to help someone and give his last. I cannot wait to see what he's going to be doing in the next 5 to 10 years. Purvis is an exceptional and selfless man, said co-nominator Taria Starks. He is very active in the community with our youth and continues to seek ways to empower them and give them a reason to be seen and heard and acknowledged in all positive aspects. He goes above and beyond for those who may think no one cares. Co-nominator Sherry Jones said, Purvis is invested in the community to have positive events and works tirelessly at it. Purvis continues to put the community first in all he does, nominator Ashley Caldwell said. Purvis has a heart and a desire to give back to the youth and community as a whole. He is a strong leader and one who does it from the heart, not for show or recognition. Congratulations to Purvis Williams. Our next article headline reads, Cedar Valley replaces code enforcement officer who quit. Bremer County Jail Administrator is hired by journalist Andy Malone, Cedar Falls. Longtime Bremer County Jail Administrator Adam Spray has been hired as Cedar Falls' new code enforcement officer after his predecessor was disciplined and later resigned in lieu of termination. Former code enforcement officer Greg Rickard, in his resignation letter obtained by the Courier, accused higher-ups of being unfair in handling certain nuisance properties and having inept managerial and leadership abilities. Before taking the Cedar Falls job, Spray had worked as county jail administrator, a position paying $60,129 annually for a decade, confirmed Bremer County Sheriff Dan Pickett. Pickett said he will continue working there as a part-time correctional officer jailer for $22.92 per hour. Spray began his new role in Cedar Falls on November 15th, according to the building official Jamie Castle. He will report to Castle and make $25.50 per hour. His job is to respond to complaints and proactively look for issues while helping people understand the rules in place, Castle said last week. A resident can report a complaint at City Hall or submit one at www.cedarfalls.com/requesttracker.aspx. Castle took on the bulk of code enforcement responsibilities in an all-hands-on-deck approach after Rewerts left about 2 months ago. She presented the city's recommendation for 4 nuisance properties during the condemnation hearing of the City Council on November 15th. A majority of councilors voted in favor of a Thursday deadline for property representatives to submit abated plans. The position was created in April of 2019. Before that, the responsibilities were handled by the fire department, or now known as the public safety officer. Spray was named Rickert's successor after being interviewed and scoring the highest in the anonymous civil service testing. He beat out 7 other candidates. His selection does not require City Council approval. He was the best fit for the position based on his qualifications, said Castle, who noted Spray had previous experience in code enforcement. Courier archives show Spray was a Cedar Falls Reserve officer prior to 2010. Pickett noted Spray applied for the code enforcement job when it was first created in 19. He said Spray didn't provide a specific reason for stepping down, but noted the new job was a better fit for his family, given that the jail administrator role requires someone to be available at all hours. Rickert's departure. After more than 2 years with the city, Rickert's, in his 2,700-word resignation email to the city officials, said he enjoyed the rewarding role of code enforcement officer, but he felt compelled for the overall betterment of the city and the next person who occupies this position to share his thoughts about Castle and Community Development Director Stephanie Hoke-Sheets, who heads the department overseeing the Code Enforcement Division and exposed some weaknesses and overreach of power. Sheets and Castle declined to comment on an employment-related matter. Reached by telephone, Rework also did not wish to comment. It's when code enforcement began to get bullied that the position lost its luster. When unwritten policy continued to change, began to show up in written discipline, and when verbal became the unwritten policy that fluctuated from case to case, week by week, I could read the writing on the wall that my days were numbered. In my view, code enforcement should be placed under the police department or the fire department due to the unbiased ability to enforce and understand legalities. January 30, 2020 employee counseling form obtained by the Courier details a significant number of errors in some of Rework's past work and that his department supervisors said could have been avoided through better note-taking or slowing down and reviewing the work before sending it in. March 23rd disciplinary report stated Rieckert was placed on a 3-day unpaid suspension on March 24th, 25th, and 26th because of multiple issues surrounding notification letters, efficiency, accuracy, and follow-through. The notice to Rieckert stated that failure to improve your performance may result in termination of your employment. Rieckert disagreed with the mandate that he must never directly communicate with the mayor or city council without Castle Arshit's consent. When asked why, the answer was because there will be certain things. We do not want them to know how things are handled. We also do not want them to use the position of code enforcement. Rieckert contended it is beneficial to keep the officials informed. The disciplinary notice signed by Castle notes Greg should always consult with Jamie and or Stephanie prior to responding to emails elected officials unless they are calling as a citizen regarding their own property. Rieckert also provided a list of examples when he disagreed with his supervisors and felt it was wrong to have been told to take disciplinary action against properties. He contends he was told to levy points against property on Clay Street with overflowing trash, but not to worry about another one on the same street where a complete remodel was being completed without permits. Castle reportedly made a simple phone call and told Rieckert it was cleared up. Rieckert said the explanation of why the property without permits resulted in no action. In addition, he said 53 rental properties needed new pavement in October of 2019. He wrote, it was decided to only send a partial list of 27 to the properties that Stephanie decided upon. When I asked why, not the entire list, her reply was, we did not want to deal with the other owners at this time. They can have more time. So I prepared the letters for the 27. The next week, I was told to not send letters at all by Jamie Castle because Stephanie and she had decided it was too close to the upcoming election. They did not want to upset landlords this close to the election for Mayor Jim Brown. In the end, he sent legal notice to 53 properties, although he was later told that 27 letters were supposed to be sent, as opposed to the entire list. An example of verbal demands fluctuating and the constant change of direction of order leading to misunderstanding. The counseling form, dated January 30th, 2020, notes 43 notices were sent out by Rieckert when only 28 should have been, because those 28 were significantly past due. In his letter, he also alleged there were cases of planning and zoning oversights being responsible for code violations and conflicts. Okay, listeners, you are listening to the reading of the Cedar Falls Waterloo paper for Tuesday, November 30th, 2021 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. All right, our first one is Terry Allen Winkie, November 26, 1944 to November 27, 2021. I really hadn't planned on going away so soon, but it's been one hell of a ride. Born in Waukegan, Illinois to Daryl and Virginia Houston Winkie, we moved to Shell Rock, Iowa, and I started school in 1949. Growing up in Shell Rock was a wonderful experience and a time like no other. It was our whole world, and we had everything we needed all in one block. So sorry to see that go away. While walking to school one day, I saw the most beautiful girl in the world, and we soon became high school sweethearts. Connie Willoughby and I were married on June 29, 1961, and we began our life together as a family with the arrival of our daughter, Terry Lynn, and son, Nick Allen. After graduation in 1962, work began. Waverly Publishing, Titus Manufacturing, Cedar Falls Police Department, and then in business for myself, owning and managing Amber Lounge, Bojangles, and Wink's Last Chance Saloon. Sports was always a big part of my life. First was fast pitch softball, and I was honored to have played with and against some of the finest players of that time. Golf was next, and everything we did centered around golf. Couples golf, league plays, events, tournaments, and then there was the gang. The gang was Steve, Chuck, Bo, Bob, Norm, and I. We thought we owned the world, but we were just a bunch of jerks having fun, and boy, did we have fun. Next came the time for us to watch. First it was Nick, All-State football, then Brandon, State Championship wrestling, and Chase, All-State soccer. Now I'm older and time to do something easier, mowing my grass and growing flowers. I spend many hours planting and tending to my large variety of flowers, grown mostly in my backyard, where only a select few friends get to admire. I also have enjoyed many hours sitting on my deck swing, just enjoying the sight and smells. My beautiful Connie left me in 2011, leaving a large hole in my life. She left behind Minnie, who was also taken over my heart and helped me through the difficult times. Sorry I can't be here to see my four beautiful great-grandkids, Lexi, Jackson, Benny, and Braxton, grow up, but I know they will all do well. Preceded in death by his wife, Connie, parents Daryl and Virginia, grandson Chase, and our dogs Scooter and Scamp. Survived by son Nick and his spouse Shannon, grandson Brandon and Melissa, four great-grandchildren, sister Mavis, nieces Shelley and Kendra, Minnie, and a few special friends. Terry was president of the Cedar Falls Police Protective Association, which was instrumental in bringing entertainment into the city for benefit shows and providing donations to many area residents. He also served as vice president and treasurer for Northeast Iowa Peace Officers Association and was one of the founding members of Cedar Falls Golf Association, serving as president and assisting in the building of the Pheasants Ridge Clubhouse Edition. He also served as vice president of the Cedar Falls Bar Owners Association. While serving with the Cedar Falls Police Department, he worked as patrol officer and later became head of the Juvenile Division of Investigation Unit, acting as liaison officer to all of the Cedar Falls schools. Terry was awarded the Distinguished Service Award for his contribution to the city of Cedar Falls. Gathering of family and friends will be from 12:30 to 2:30 Wednesday, December 1st, 2021, at the Richardson Funeral Service in Cedar Falls, with interment in the Fairview Cemetery, Cedar Falls. There will be a reception at the Cedar Falls Amvets Post 49 following the interment. Online condolences may be left at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. Next is Deborah McDermott, Atlantic. Deborah McDermott, 70, of Atlantic, Iowa, passed away Friday, November 26, 2021. Deborah Jane was born June 22, 1951, in Cedar Falls, Iowa, the daughter of Glenn and Mary Jane Schwantz Holmes. Deborah graduated from Northern University High School in Cedar Falls. Following graduation, she attended Simpson College. She is survived by her husband John of Atlantic, children Mike and his spouse Liz Reed McDermott of Atlantic, Melanie and Justin Gross of Winterset, special daughter Mariana Fitchens of Salvador, Brazil, seven grandchildren, sister Doreen, Ed Shellhouse of Ankeny, stepmother Freddie Holmes of Cedar Falls, and numerous nieces, nephews, and extended family and friends. She's preceded in death by her parents, Glenn and Mary Jane Holmes. A celebration of life memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, December 4th, 2021, at Roland Funeral Home in Atlantic. Visitation with the family present will be held prior to the service at the funeral home on Saturday beginning at 9:30 a.m. Memorials may be directed to the family for later designation to the Multiple Sclerosis Society of Iowa and Shriners Hospital. Condolences may be left at www.rolandfuneralservice.com. Edward Joseph Pearson, Cedar Falls, was 83, died Sunday, November 28, 2021, at Park Ridge Specialty Care in Pleasant Hill, Iowa. He was born on October 4, 1983, in Admire, Kansas, the son of Frank and Goldie Scalburr Pearson. Edward was married on May 13, 1961, to Gloria Meeman in Albert Lea, Minnesota. He worked in tool and die for John Deere. He is survived by his son Patrick and spouse Carla Pearson of Cambridge, a daughter-in-law George Pearson of Shell Rock, five grandchildren, Justin, Becca, Sydney, Paige, and Allie, a sister Leanne Schmidt of Leavenworth, Kansas, and a brother Paul and Kathy Pearson of Topeka, Kansas. He was preceded in death by his parents, his wife Gloria, and two sons, Parnell Pearson and Byron Pearson. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. on Wednesday, December 1, 2021, at First United Methodist Church in Cedar Falls. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the funeral, and interment will be in Greenwood Cemetery, Cedar Falls. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online guest book at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. Earl Brandt of Sumner was 90, died Friday, November 26, 2021, at the Hillcrest Home in Sumner. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, November 30th at St. John Lutheran Church in Sumner, with Reverend Tracy Hinkle officiating. Interment will follow at the church cemetery, rural Sumner, with military rites provided by Thomas E. Woods Post No. 223, American Legion of Sumner. Visitation will precede services at the church on Tuesday starting at 9:30. Memorials may be made in Earl's name to Seams or the Sumner Volunteer Fire Department. Becker and Son Funeral Home in Sumner is assisting Earl's family. Online condolences may be left at www.beckermillsreading.com. Earl Lewis, son of Art and Minnie Stege Brandt, was born May 30, 1931, at home in rural Bremer County. He was baptized, confirmed in the Lutheran faith. Earl graduated from Waverly High School in 1949. While in high school, he participated in the Waverly wrestling team. Following his graduation, Earl honorably served in the U.S. Navy during the Korean conflict. On October 26, 1952, he married Shirley Teat at St. Matthew's Lutheran Church in Reedland. To this union, four sons were born: Daniel, Jeff, Kevin, and Stephen. The couple purchased a farm north of Sumner in 1960. Earl thoroughly enjoyed farming and did so until his health no longer permitted. He was a member of St. John Lutheran Church in Sumner for many years, where he served several terms on the church council. Earl was also a longtime member of the Corn Growers Association, Soybean Association, Sumner Rotary, Thomas E. Woods Post No. 223, American Legion of Sumner. In addition to his love of farming, Earl enjoyed traveling around the world, watching rodeos on television, and conversing with family and friends. Earl is survived by his sons, Jeff and Stacy, Kevin and Amy, both of Sumner, Stephen of Hong Kong, China, and eight grandchildren, Mackenzie and Kyle Buska, Quinton and Kelsey, Kaylin, Isaiah, Jenna, Morgan, Owen, and Cooper, brother-in-law, Rodney, and Eileen Horgan of Brooklyn, sister-in-law Carol Brand of Sioux City, and several nieces and nephews. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his wife Shirley in 2020, son Daniel in 1965, a brother Arnold Brandt, and sister Eileen Benning. Next, we have Lauren Bernard Scott, Jr. of Waterloo, was 49, died November 25th, 2021 at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital due to COVID. He was born January 14, 1972 in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of late Lauren B. Scotty Scott and Orlean Scott Black. Lauren attended high school, East High School, from 1986 to 1990, graduated from high school and continued his education at Kirkwood Community College, majoring in criminal justice studies. He also attended Hawkeye Community College. After pursuing his educational endeavors, Lauren worked for numerous years with Alpha Services, and he also worked as a salesperson for Blessed Hair Boutique. Lauren served as an assistant operational manager to final employer, Mid Valley Industrial Services, that he worked for 2.5 years. He leaves to grieve his beloved mother, Aura Lee, and Ben Black, 3 sisters, Stephanie M. Scott of Denver, Colorado, Enid Nickel Bruce Wilson of Des Moines, and Pamela Young of Aurora, Colorado. In addition to the aforementioned, Lauren is survived by 3 brothers, Jordan Jerome Hodge of Aurora, Colorado, Desmond Cage of San Antonio, Texas, and Lauren Carl Austin of Waterloo. Preceded in death by his father, Lauren B. Scott, Sr., and both paternal and maternal grandparents. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, December 4th at Hagerty Wyckoff Garup Funeral Service on South Street with interment in Fairview Cemetery. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to service time on Saturday. Memorials may be directed to Hagerty Wyckoff Garup Funeral Service on 400 Street, South Street, Waterloo, 50701. Condolences may be left with www.hagertywyckoffgarup.com. Eberhard Lothar Schmidt, 68, of Waterloo, Iowa, formerly of Neustadt by Cologne, died Tuesday, November 23, 2021. He was born April 5, 1953, in Wildehyde, Germany, and came to the United States to marry Christy Myers on January 17, 1981. Eberhard was a Panzergrenadier in the German Federal Armed Forces from 1976 to 1978. Upon coming to the United States in Iowa, he worked for Cardinal Construction for many years, retiring in 2015. He enjoyed working with his friends at Cardinal, loved his family and his 2 cats, loved to travel to Europe and the U.S., and especially loved following German soccer and his favorite team, FC Bayern Munich. He is survived by his wife of 40 years, Christy Myers Schmidt of Waterloo, his beloved German exchange student daughter, Stephanie Leisch, and his children, Felix and Leah Holzinger, Germany, brother Holly Schmidt and sister Isa Totz, Maria Locke and Sylvia Metzler, both of Germany, and godchild in Germany, Andres Totz, Sabina Loke, Jacqueline Garter, and Felix Leisch. His Iowa family included brother-in-law Robert Myers and Rick Myers, his sister-in-law Kathy Button, as well as numerous nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, Rudy and Gunther Schmidt, and a brother, Jürgen Schmidt. A celebration of life will be held at 7 p.m. on Monday, December 13th, at St. Timothy Lutheran Church in Hudson, Iowa. The family respectfully requests that attendees wear masks. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to Cedar Bend Humane Society. Online condolences may be left at https://www.locksfuneralhome.com. Next, we have Evelyn Marie Craig, 86, of Waterloo, died Friday, November 26, 2021, at Mercy One Medical Center. She was born on October 30, 1935, in Duckerton, Iowa, the daughter of James and Agnes Ruder Wachenberg. Evelyn married Roger A. Craig on November 5, 1955, at St. John's Catholic Church in Waterloo. Evelyn attended St. John's grade school and graduated from St. Mary's High School. Evelyn worked at Rath Packing Company in the office for 12 years and later drove school bus for Waterloo Community Schools for 22 years. She was a member of the Catholic Daughters of America. She is survived by 2 daughters, Beth and Bob Starbuck, Rita and Jim Condrahardy, both of Waterloo, and a son, Marty and Sarah Craig of Fishers, Indiana. 8 grandchildren, Sarah Mark Gallagher, Christopher Julie Starbuck, Allison Obermeyer, Hannah and Justin Lynn, Alex and Cody Wilson, Joyce and Jonathan Mackin, Craig and Alex Conradi, Brooke and Taylor Ashtinter, and 9 great-grandchildren, Carter and Gavin Gallagher, Emma and Grant Augenbier, Easton and Peyton Wilson, Lydia and Henry Starbuck, Eleanor Lynn and Barrett Ashtenberger, a sister Bev Rick Albright, and several brother-in-laws and sister-in-laws. Preceded in death by her husband Roger, a daughter, Laura Jo, and her parents. Services will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, December 2nd at Queen of Peace Catholic Church with burial in Mount Olive Cemetery. Public visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, December 1st at Hagerty Wyckoff Garup Funeral Service on South Street, where there will be a 4 p.m. rosary. Memorials may be made to Queen of Peace Catholic Church, Friendship Village, and Cedar Valley Catholic Schools, and the Alzheimer's Association. Online condolences may be left at www.hagertywyckoffgarup.com. Marvel Jean Hansen of Cedar Falls was age 95, died Sunday, November 28, 2021, at New Aldea Lifescapes in Cedar Falls. She was born September 26, 1926, the daughter of Elvin and Katie Stube Toombs in Ardell, Iowa. Marvel graduated from Dyke High School in the class of 1943 on February 11, 1944. She was united in marriage to George Hansen in Dyke, Iowa. She worked as a bookkeeper at Morrison Rhinebeck Elevator in 1960s and in the 70s for Iowa Savings Bank of Dyke. She is survived by her daughter, Brenda, and spouse, John Perry, of Dyke, 2 sons, John Hansen of Cedar Falls, and Jim and spouse, Connie Hansen of Waterloo, 11 grandchildren and numerous great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her husband, George, 2 sons, Bob and Phil, a daughter, Sarah, and a granddaughter, Amanda. A gathering of family and friends will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, December 1st, 2021, at Richardson Funeral Service in Cedar Falls. Memorials may be directed to the family to be forwarded to the PKD Foundation. Online guest book at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. Marvel always enjoyed crocheting and knitting, but her biggest enjoyment was cooking and baking for her large family and entertaining at the holidays and family gatherings. She baked and cooked right up to the time that she became ill. She and George moved from Dyke to northern Minnesota after retiring. They spent many years enjoying fishing and wildlife at their lake home, which they always referred to as home. She will be missed by all. All right, listeners, let's go to some sports news today. College sports. A.J. Green named Conference Player of the Week. Hall, Shudock, Colshire also earned nods. By journalist Hart Pisani. It's been a heck of a week for college athletics in Iowa. The University of Iowa is going to be in the Big Ten Championship in football. Iowa State men's basketball team upset Memphis Tigers, and the UNI men's basketball team upset St. Bonaventure. Those are some pretty big accomplishments, and people took notice. 4 different college athletes from Iowa universities earned Conference Player of the Week honors for this past week. They were UNI junior A.J. Green won Missouri Valley Player of the Week. Brees Hall of Iowa State was named Big 12 Offensive Player of the Week, while Caleb Shondock of Iowa, the Big 10 Special Teams Player of the Week. Gabe Colshire of the Cyclones in the Big 12 Player of the Week for men's basketball. Green earned the honor for his role in the Panthers' 90-80 upset victory over the Bonnies on Saturday. Green, a Cedar Falls product, scored 35 points in the UNI road win. moving him to 14th place all time in school history. Green nailed 9 three-pointers in the contest, tying the school record for most in a game. Hall's win was so impressive after the performance he put up for the Cyclones, which was 48-14 win over TCU on Friday. He was outstanding in rushing for 242 yards and scored 4 touchdowns. Hall has rushed for a score of 24 consecutive games, an NCAA record. Shudock's leg was needed in the Hawkeyes' 28-21 comeback victory over Nebraska on Friday. The former walk-on connected on all 4 of his field goal attempts from distances of 51, 48, 36, and 44 yards. The senior is 22-25 on the season on field goals and perfect on extra points. Finally, Kolscher earned the Men's Player of the Week and Newcomer of the Week awards after leading Iowa State University to wins over 2 ranked opponents. The senior scored 30 points in the Cyclones' 78-59 upset win over previously 9th-ranked Memphis to go with 8 rebounds and 5 steals on Friday. That was after the 6'4 guard put up 12 points, 5 boards, and 3 steals against previous 25th-ranked Xavier on Wednesday. The Cyclones are currently 6-0 on the season and are now winner of the NIT season tip-off. Congratulations to the Players of the Week. Also in sports news, we have the Iowa-Michigan earn unexpected title chance. Few picked the Hawkeyes and Wolverines for Big Ten final, by journalist Steve Batterson. Belief has turned into reality for the unexpected opponents that will play for a Big Ten football championship next weekend. Neither Iowa or Michigan were the preseason picks to win their division, but Sunday, both the 15th-ranked Hawkeyes and 2nd-ranked Wolverines began preparations for their matchup in Saturday's 7 p.m. title game at Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. Iowa coach Kurt Ferentz said Sunday the Hawkeyes were able to build a 10-2 record and win the Big Ten West at 7-2 by overcoming adversity, early injuries, and an offensive line, consecutive midseason losses to Purdue and Wisconsin, and an injury that sidelined starting quarterback Spencer Petras during the final weeks of the season. It's all about how you finish. It's about staying with what you're doing and then dealing with whatever challenges come your way, friends said. Some of our older guys understood because they've been through some of the seasons we've had. But we're fortunate our younger guys believed it too. That's where it all starts. Michigan coach Jim Harbaugh senses the same from a team that has ridden the strength of its defense to an 11-1 record during a season that ended with an empathetic 42-27 win Saturday over Ohio State, the Wolverines' first since 2011. There were plenty of questions about where Michigan's program was at entering the 2021 season, starting with a defense that improved statistically as much as any team in the Big Ten. Harbaugh believes the Wolverines have answered many of them, and he sees Michigan's first ever Big Ten title game appearance as a step toward meeting its goals. The thing that hits me is that in some respects, this is a new beginning for us, Harbaugh said. We'll try to continue to have great days in practice, get ourselves healthy, and get ourselves ready to go play this game. Harbaugh referenced the 1980 United States Olympic hockey team and its upset win over the Soviet Union when talking about how his team needed to move forward this week following its win over the Buckeyes. That win in 1980 was a great win, but it wasn't for gold. That team had to back out and play again to win, Harbaugh said. This week, this is the championship game against a great Iowa team in Indianapolis. Harbaugh said the Wolverines have been in playoff mode the past couple of weeks, something that won't change this week. If we want to advance, get ourselves to the college semifinals, we have to win this week. All right, well, good luck to them both, listeners. And it's time to start wrapping up the reading of today's Courier. And I like to finish with my favorite part of the paper, and maybe it is yours as well, called Call the Courier. Let's see if I can locate it for you. There we go. Call the Courier for today, Thursday, November 30th, 2021. Question: are there Haitian immigrants being housed at the Western Home in Cedar Falls? Answer: per Linda Hudwalker Bowman, Chief Communications Officer with Western Home Communities, no. However, Western Home Communities fully supports a national coalition of long-term care providers who have urged the State Department to expedite requests from qualified nurses of many backgrounds who are trying to get visas to work in the U.S. We're also working with other sponsors around the country on this issue. There was already a critical shortage of healthcare and hospital workers before COVID-19 hit, and we need to do everything possible to provide enough quality caregivers for the large population of aging baby boomers. Question: what does the term fourth estate mean? Answer: it refers to the press, the profession of journalism. Its origin goes back to the European concept of the three estates of the realm, the clergy, the nobility, and the commoners. In the United States, the press is sometimes referred to as the fourth estate because it serves as watchdog over the three branches of government, executive, legislative, and judicial. And listeners, that wraps it up for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls paper, The Courier, for Tuesday, November 30th, 2021. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.